You know, I think I'm in a situation where I get to do the things that I do well.
Was the first band that you had under your own name that led that Albert Ankrum?
Yes.
And how did you...
That's not true. Like, way back at Loyola, there were a couple of gigs called the Jeff Albert Quartet, but it was totally like, just go read standards. Although it was a great band. Brian Blade was on a couple of them.
Yeah, yeah, in those days, it's amazing. So how did you, the Albert Ankrum thing occur?
Cassandra Faulkner, who at the time was married to Larry Ankrum, Cass and Larry were friends of mine from the cruise ships, and they had just moved to town, and we said, hey, let's put a band together.
What was the aim? Were there any particular aims with the band, or was there any particular writing things going
Play jazz and be cool and get some gigs.
Okay, good. And did that work out?
On a limited scale, it was, yeah, it was okay. I mean, it was definitely a step in the progression for me artistically. I mean, we had some reasonable gigs, you know. We played a Satchmo Summerfest and got on a OZ Pledge Drive sampler, you know. Like, there were some reasonable successes for that band.
It felt rewarding.
Yeah. I still run into people that say, oh, I've got that record, you know. So like,
oh, yeah,
yeah.
I think it's funny. The thing about Larry that's so funny to me is the guy could, he's one of the best readers I ever came across. I mean, it was unbelievable what he could read. I used to write really absurd things. Like, now I would never even put it on paper, but I would put it there. And he was the only guy that nailed those notes ever. And he nailed them, like, you know, that upbeat 30-second note thing. Like, bam. Sort of thing where everyone looks around and goes, oh, that's supposed to be there. You can finally hear it.
Yeah. So, oh, that's how that lick goes. Okay, now we can all play it because we've heard him do it. Yeah.
Like to do it. It's pretty striking. So, and okay, so that lasted a little while. What else were you getting into? Was that the main act, or were you trying to open up in some other directions too? Or what was going on?
Right around that time was when I started playing with you.
Orchestra, right?
Naked Orchestra things.
So that's what, 1999 or something?
Yeah, probably 2000, I think, was maybe when I started.
I can't remember. Were you on the first Naked Orchestra record?
No, I was on the record, yeah.
You're on the first Naked Orchestra record.
I was not on the first Naked Orchestra gig. No, that I started on the second gig.
Yeah, you couldn't have been on the first Naked Orchestra gig because that was, yeah.
But right. I started on the second gig, not too long before the second Naked Orchestra gig.
Wow.
I did the first Davis, Rogan, Peter, and the Wolf thing. And we played at the Mermaid Lounge after we had played at the Kids Tent at Jazz Fest. And after the gig, you came up to me and you said, my band needs a trombone player and I need your phone number.
Okay.
And that was the beginning of the end of my career. All the good music came after that.
I brought them down. Let me see.
And that was really my entrance into the more, to really discovering the more creative things that were going on in town. Because through doing those early Naked Orchestra gigs, I met James Singleton and Michael Ray and Jimbo and Rob Wagner. And, you know, like, there were all these people that I sort of knew of, like James and Michael I obviously knew of, but really just first got to deal with them as a colleague, you know, and to finally meet Tim Green and people like that. Yeah. And so that opened up a bunch of doors to me, which eventually I started playing in the Cosmic Crew with Michael.
Right.
Which really was a huge turning point for me in terms of realizing what I was capable of doing and sort of what I should be doing. Musically, at least.
How did it give you this kind of a moral position?
I don't know if moral position as much as commercial position. Like, hey, these are the things you actually sound good doing. But there was this thing with Michael where everything was always on the table. We could be playing like a Lee Morgan tune or some crazy No Time Sun Ra thing. And Michael was liable to play exactly the same thing in either of those situations if it was what the music needed at that moment. You know, in the middle of the bebop tune, Michael might do this strange, abstract, running squeal. And in the middle of the abstract noisy tune, he might play a bebop lick. But it always worked. It was, and the thing that I realized was, coming out of the academy and the jazz education mindset, was I always had on like my filter of, okay, this is this kind of gig, so these are the things I'm allowed to do. Mm-hmm. This is this kind of tune. Okay, I'm at Snug Harbor, so I can't do that thing because I'm at Snug. I could do that thing if I was at the Dragon's Den, but I'm at Snug, so I can't do that. Mm-hmm. And what I realized with Michael is that that's all bullshit. Mm-hmm. Everything is always on the table, mm-hmm. and your taste will guide you. Mm-hmm. So there are still times at Snug where my taste tells me not to do that, but it's not because I flipped some switch in my brain that says this is not allowable. It's off the table here. And once everything's on the table, you get such a better sense of flow because you're not trying to censor while you're doing it. Mm-hmm. You're just hearing music and trying to let that music that you're hearing flow. And when you get the censor out of the way, it's so much easier. Mm-hmm.
So those times, these are now, this is before the storm, the period you're talking about with the open years. And what were the clubs that you played at with those, these times?
The Naked Orchestra, we played Tipitina's a few times. We actually made some money on a couple of those gigs. The Dragon's Den seemed to really be a focal point for the more interesting creative things at that point in time.
Mm-hmm. And so...
Although, oddly enough, like when I played reggae gigs there too, I would play the Dragon's Den with the Cosmic Crew, and then I'd play the Dragon's Den with Cool Rhythms and Sister Titi, and it was.
Okay. And then, so were these the experiences playing at this point when the. I'm trying to work out now, at what point did the Chicago stuff become.
I had sort of started to explore that music then. I didn't go up there until after Katrina. Jeb and I had developed a little relationship.
But you'd had some records.
Yeah, I had some records, definitely.
Yeah, I'm just trying to spot it because at a certain point here I'm going to ask about sound and scenario comparisons, your style comparisons. But so this is all running up to the storm, and then...
It's funny how there's that chronological delineator there.
Yeah, I mean, it's an odd chronological delineator, but since we started before you were... I mean, the reason is because I'm really just sort of trying to address what you said initially, which was there wasn't a place for people to be doing...
there were places, and then there was a little vacuum in that, at least to my perception. When I started the Open Ears, there wasn't anyone that I could call and say... Hey, I've got this crazy idea and I want to come do it in your club. Mm. Wouldn't have to just argue with them. Mm. Like my goal for the Open Ears was, if you have some crazy whack ass idea, call me. I want you to do it here. So it's enough hard work and a hard enough time to get these things to happen without having to fight with somebody about booking it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the funny thing was I didn't have to fight about booking until... Mermaid clothes. I mean,
the Mermaid. That was the other place.
I mean, for me, that was the death knell for that whole thing of you can do anything anywhere. Because it used to be you could also do it at Checkpoint Drive. All the clubs used to be interested in anything.
Well, see, and you had that relationship at the Mermaid where you could call them and say, what's open?
I had the relationship with almost everywhere at that point. I could get in.
And that was the scene I had with Mario at King Bolden's. I didn't even have to call him. He would call me.
They would call you. They call you.
And say, what night do you want?
Yeah, exactly. It's a lovely, lovely zone to be in, and so you created that, and so since then, as a result of that, I mean, what has come out of here as a result of the Open Ears?
I'm tentative to say that anything has come out as a result of the Open Ears because there's community and there's other things going on. Rob Cambry has been booked.
Dude, there's a guy, there's an independent fellow. I do actually know his name, but he's made stickers that say, what would Jeff Albert do?
Okay.
There's been some impact.
Yeah, okay, fine. Admitted. But it's not a lone voice. Rob Cambry's been booking crazy ass shit for a long time in this town. for a while before he had 8 o'clock classes, Andy Derta was booking a lot of interesting things and making weird things happen. So I don't want on any level to, you know, Benjamin Lyons is a great supporter and occasionally would make things happen as well. You know, I don't want to put it out as like, oh, this is this thing that I did. This is like, maybe I instigated it, but the good that comes of it, the things that come out of it are coming from the community, not so much from me.
Let me put it this way.
That being said, I'm proud of the fact that I think some good music has happened because that venue has been available.
I was wanting to bring up something here that's interesting to me about Open Ears, which is that the other few things, Rob Gambry, Benjamin Lyons, Andy's thing, they really flirt around mostly with established musicians.
And people from out of town, yeah.
That are established. And so, but the Open Ears, you have all these really young guys in there all the time.
Well, that's the advantage of having to put something up there every week. You know, if I did it once a month, I could like say, okay, January is Jonathan, and February is James Singleton, and March is Tim Green, and I could have like only people that would, you know.
But you have every week in there, but. What are some of the things you've seen develop out of there, I should say? You know, in other words, like, there's other things that have developed in turn.
Oh, what are some things? You know, Will Thompson's band, What If?
Mm-hmm.
He's done a lot of work with that, and they've played some other gigs, but I'm proud to say some of the earlier functionings of that were on Open Ears things. I think the availability of that venue helped get that to the point it is. The return of Neslort, I think, was at least facilitated a little bit by the availability of that spot.
A trombone band.
Which is great, because when I first moved to town, like, if you wanted to go hear crazy-ass trombone playing, Rick was the only option.
Yeah.
You know, so that was super cool. I think the fact that there are people that I don't know that aren't musicians that come in there on a Tuesday night and hear sometimes some screaming weird ass shit, mm-hmm. and don't freak out and leave. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that I'm most proud of about it. I think it has, I'll use the pun, opened the ears of the audience here some. Mm-hmm. And and you know, it's gotten a little bit of recognition beyond our watery borders here in New Orleans.
Really?
Yeah, you know, there was a little article in the May Downbeat on it, and, you know, I had this guy come to the gig the other night. He came up and started talking after. Turns out he's from Utah. I said, oh, because I'd never seen him before. I said, you should come back every week. We got crazy stuff going on. He says, oh, I'm just in town. I live in Utah. And I said, oh, great. Well, you know, like, go to the website, because we've got archives of lots of this stuff. He said, yeah, I know. That's why I'm here. You know, so, like, people know about it. So I think it, on another level, the fact that people are aware that there are things happening in New Orleans that can fall outside of the sort of stereotype of what people think happens in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. I think that's good.
So initially the purpose was to get yourself a gig.
Absolutely. It was totally selfish. It's like, I need a place to play.
And now your purpose is what?
Still to have a gig where I don't have to argue with, I just have to write myself in. No, the purpose is to have a place that allows interesting things to happen.
Okay.
To have a place where people can present creative ideas without having to argue with someone to book it.
Okay. And so what's involved in that? Just saying yes?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, good.
I mean, the relationship with the club is very good. And so I'm now kind of filling the holes. People tend to come to me. It's very rare that I have to pick up the phone and call somebody and say, oh, I've got this spot to fill.
It's extraordinary to me that people think it's so difficult, and really the solution is just to say yes. I always want to tell people that are booking music that, like, you know, stop worrying about it and start saying yes and stick them on the bill, and things will develop.
Yeah.
So it's good to hear it from you, because you actually developed something like
that. And you know, the funny thing is, like, gig hardly pays anything. If I could change anything about it, it would be to figure out some way to get the musicians more money. Yeah. But I still have people bugging the crap out of me to come play. It's like, you realize there's no money involved here. But people, like, want a place where they don't have to look over their shoulder. And that's part of the beauty of the relationship with the club, since there really is no financial relationship with the club, is he doesn't give me any grief about what we book. He never says, oh, you know, that band didn't do so well. The bar sales were... You know, Jesse never says anything
to me. Do you think there's a way to boost the money?
I've got my thoughts. I'm working on it.
Yeah.
The key is to find a way to boost the money without handing over some artistic control. It's more important to me that it remains a situation where whoever plays feels completely free to do whatever they want to do. Mm-hmm. That's more important to me than being able to pay them more money. That's I would true. Like to be able to do both.
But don't you think, you know, like, for instance, like, your reason for staying in trombone when you were younger was because there were some rewards in being a professional musician. In other words, you developed somewhat from being rewarded that way.
Yes. But the unfortunately, at this point, the reward of this situation is you have a place to do it.
Yeah, I agree, but...
When I win my MacArthur grant, I'll just fund it myself, and it won't be a problem.
Right,
you know.
So I'm just bringing it up as an interesting
thing. Yeah, no, I've spent lots of, you know, wailing and gnashing of teeth hours trying to figure it out.
I mean, I'm very, very much in. I really love what you do over there because, for you know, I've explained to a lot of people, if you're not getting paid, then the relative ease has to be there. If there is the relative ease, actually, it can provide more musical situation than all the money that you pay.
Right.
But it has to be really properly easy so that everybody can really get down to discussion of feeling comfortable or feeling something or not worrying mm-hmm. about parameters. And so, you know, and that situation has to be there if you're going to get into it. Anything more interesting, I think. I'm asserting now I'm a bit editorializing, whatever, you know.
That's okay. Really That's why they call it conversation.
It's a conversation. So, you know, I can understand that. But the question has to be asked anyway, you know. So this is what it's changed into. And do you feel like the people that come through, the musicians that come through there and the players that come through there, all have similar ideas? Or what is the diversity of things that are going on here?
I think it's pretty widely diverse, mm-hmm. actually. I don't know. That's interesting. To be honest, I haven't spent a whole lot of time thinking about comparing and contrasting the ideas of the various people that have come through.
Yeah, maybe that's my job. There's no... no, I don't know. That's my job. I guess sort of somewhat what I'm up to here.
I think that's an interesting thing to ask. My first response to that question is I would say that it's healthily diverse. But, you know, I haven't really gone through and looked at it mm-hmm. to see that that's the case. My instinct is, oh yeah, there's lots of different stuff going on.
Mm-hmm. But what the stuff is...
But, like, if I go week to week and look at it, is there really? I think so.
Because, you know, I'm just trying to get down to, like, what the ideas, like, somebody who is an open musician or an experimental or something doing creative, what are the ideas that are involved, and what, you know, what does the frame of ears contain, or what has it contained, or who's attracted to that? I mean, obviously, it's not...
It's contained... Everything from, like, real straight ahead jazz with a capital J
yeah.
to improvised electronic music to, you know, like, noise guitars and percussion.
Mm-hmm.
We've had some classical chamber ensembles up there once or twice. Mm-hmm. It's over the 3.5 years been pretty widely varied. I've found that the electronic stuff is tough in there, mm-hmm. which is hard for me because that's an area that I'm branching out into more and more. but it just doesn't seem to work as well in that setting. Or maybe the crowd doesn't expect it. I've found things that are broadly characterized as from the free jazz lineage, we're back to that term, seem to work the best. Mm-hmm. But that's a pretty broad swath.
Maybe it's the rhythmic feature.